Rusty, live on the pod, Kirk Vallis, live from his bedroom. How you doing, mate? You all right?
In my bedding room. I have a room.
I'm just so tired. The fatigue is setting in. Isolation is killing me.
That is the kind of thing you would do now with isolation, is just create a room just for bedding and towels, just to sort through stuff. You know?
Just pretend I'm doing sorting stuff out, but then sleep. That's what you would definitely do.
Well, we've two young ones, one four, five weeks now, bless him. It's not easy. It's not easy work. But there we go. Anyway.
Cool. Do you want to explain to people who you are, how you've ended up here?
Yeah, let's do it. So day job at Google. That seems to be why I'm here. Really, I always wonder if I leave Google, will people still invite me to come and do things?
I would still invite you.
Yeah, good. Thank you. Well, Google in talent development, I focus on creativity. So it's a critical skill. We talk about it a lot. We talk about innovation and creativity at Google. So we also think we should train people to be better at it, like we do other skills and knowledge and technical expertise. It's quite interesting in itself how many people how many organizations where you look at their values and what they stand for and what they try and do. And then, you ask what kind of formal investment they give to that. And sometimes very little, if none at all. So we put our money where our mouth is, and we train, we develop that as a skill. So that's my job, is developing Googlers globally. A lot of work on leaders now, interestingly. How do we use creativity to solve problems? You know, whether it's small every day, how do I do this meeting a bit better, right through to how do we help users just have a better relationship with their tech? And then that privilege, if you like, on that job affords me the opportunity to then go and kick around some stuff with people like you and the English FA. Interestingly, I now run a module on both the UEFA Pro license and the technical director's course on creative problem solving, which, I think is a really good sign of how this word creativity is finding itself into the mainstream of critical skill set in lots of worlds.
Nice. And a couple of things that I was just thinking about there. One was, most school websites would talk about creativity, however, they would only associate it with sport or the arts. They would rarely associate it with the classroom. And I guess lots of people, when the word's mentioned, so if I ever mention it, our connection actually came from me getting more curious about creativity and the sea of cards. People will almost immediately go, yeah, but I'm not very creative, Rusty.
Yeah. Oh, all the time. Like that's the number one, the number one module in anything I design is to try and knock creativity off its pedestal, to see that everybody firstly is creative, but can get better at it as well. Listen, there's lots of history here that you've just summarized nicely. School, most people probably got badged at some point in their school life as creative or not, by a very out of date definition of that word, creativity. And that's just stuck with people. And then it finds its way into business. In the business world, creativity is not seen as a particularly strategic or senior skill. You know, it's seen as a fluffy thing or something you do and nice to haves, but it's probably the opposite. If most senior leaders would like to think of themselves as strategic and, an analytical decision maker and language like that, creativity can be seen as kind of the opposite of that, which is a real shame. And that's half my job, is to help people to kind of place it back, at that top table of skill sets. Interestingly, when I've been able to hang around in the sport world, you also have to have that conversation about what do we mean by creativity, because I guess there's two things. Firstly, how do we build creativity in top talent, whether that's athletes or us as coaches and leaders? But then how do we do our job? How do we as coaches coach and lead in a creative way? So it's kind of two things, and you almost have to define both, or define which one you're talking about. Because immediately you say the word creativity in sport and everyone thinks of the flair player, and it's that, oh, you can't coach that, you can't teach that, it's nature over nurture and so on, and then you've got to knock that off its pedestal as well.
Yeah, the commentators never help with that one. They're always saying, you can't, as you say, you can't coach that. He's just naturally, he just did that when he was born. And it's useful. I mean, I guess for me, definition is about solutions to problems. So,
that's it actually. Like, you know, I think probably now the time has come. So, and this whole crisis, if there's a good thing about it, it's that people have got creative. So when people now say, oh, we can't be creative. So the NHS would say they're not a creative organisation. They've just built the world's largest hospital in 2 weeks. You know, it's that's pretty creative. That takes creativity to get around all of the, you know, the ingrained thinking and how things are done around here type stuff. So I think a lot of people are starting to offer up at least examples that people like you and I can call out and go, well, that was creative. You know, coaches, you know, checking in with their teams, their players over Hangouts and video conferencing. I did a call with the English FA with loads of the pro license graduates and current cohort, and lots of the leaders there were saying about how they're using WhatsApp that they never would have engaged with their players on WhatsApp. It was almost like, that's not what you do. That's for players to engage with each other, but not for hierarchy to engage down. And they're building such better relationships by using that. So what we're seeing is loads of people are, this situation is causing people to have to be creative, and you and I can call that out. But actually, I think if I never use the word creativity again, it doesn't matter. I'm not hung up on that word. I'm hung up on what it means. And like you said, just solving problems, coming up with new ways of doing things, big and small, to have more impact in what we do.
I guess the rules of engagement have been broken by coronavirus. And so people are now, you know, doing stuff that wouldn't fit within the normal rules of the game.
Oh, it's, you know, it's, in that sense, it's brilliant, right? The commonality I see, a big common pushback I get, whether it's business or sport, is, oh, we can't afford to fail. You know, we can't take risks there. We've got a game to win. We've got a business to run. We've got a pitch to win, whatever it is. Well, all bets are off, right? If ever there is a safe to fail environment, it's now. Because no one's expecting, we're doing this podcast probably expecting the audio to cut out at some point, you know, like, so everybody's level expectation of what of quality threshold has dropped massively in everything we do, whether it's a document I'm writing, whether it's a meeting I'm running, whether it's just planning a strategy, whatever language you want to use. And I think that's just a brilliant thing, but only a brilliant thing if we take advantage of it. So at this time where you're afforded the ability to be scrappy, you just got to be as scrappy as hell, and then hope that muscle gets built enough, and we see enough positive return from it that we actually then start to address some of the status quo, if you like, when we do get back to some normality. You know, if a classic one is people spending ages making sure their deck or their presentation is 100%, you know, aesthetically pleasing. Well, that just doesn't freaking matter. You know, it doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter now. And I hope that people will then see it doesn't matter when we do get back to in-person meetings and running your team meeting with slides and so on, and just a few hand-drawn scrappy things that you've thought out is probably okay. You know, when is good enough? Good enough is a lovely expression that I try and hold on to.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see what kind of remains when we go back to whatever is the new normal. What type of, so you talk about developing the skills of creativity. How, give me some ways you would do that.
So I think, let's think through. So as I said, number one, common language. So give it some common language. If I'm working with groups of people that work together, let them develop their common language. Like I say, if I work with engineers at Google, rarely does the word creativity go down that well. You know, it doesn't really engage that community within my organization. But I talk about problem solving, and I've got them, you know, fresh thinking skills, and I've got them. So actually just some common language that helps to knock it off its pedestal, that we can all align around, that helps to create some sort of codification, if that's a word, there you go, I'm making up language, and that we can all anchor around when we're trying to come up with new thinking. So that's number one. So give people some common language. And then for me, it's largely about behavior. You know, I have an expression, behavior eats process for breakfast. And because I see it all the time, you know, teams that have got brilliant process, this is how we do things. This is our innovation model, or this is how we run our week. This is how we structure our week between games or whatever it is. And the frameworks are there. They're brilliant. I rarely look at a framework and go, actually, no, that's totally wrong. You know, because they're all good, whether it's sprints, design thinking, Six Sigma, Lean. You know, there's so many out there that are all great innovation processes and variations of. But the reason why they work or don't work is because people bring the right behaviours. Any great framework that you have, but people still show up and criticise every piece of new thinking because their negativity bias is just protecting them, or the corporate antibodies are just sort of staying safe by not allowing us to be challenged in any way, particularly hierarchy, is a big thing. So actually giving people some behaviors that we all have inside us, but that we need to dial up when it comes to allowing new thinking to develop. Two modes of thinking for creativity for me: expansive and reductive. You know, divergent, convergent, whatever language you want to use. But simply, it's about possibility and options, and then analysis, judgment, and decision making. That's the two modes of thinking, and we need both. We need both. It's not just about the possibility and options. If all, that's all you have, that's not creativity. That's not creativity. That's crazy-tivity. That's nonsense. That's the creative muse. That's the reason why it gets a bad rep. But you need to have some of that in order to fuel your analysis, your judgment, your decision making. So common language, behaviors, bit of process, being able to navigate between those two modes of thinking, whether it's just an informal chat, two people kicking something around over a coffee, or whether it's big 2-day get together with a group of people because you're working on a project, or you've got to come up with some new ideas or services for users or people that you're working with.
Where have you seen that done well? So especially the divergent part, my kind of observations, what I've noticed in sport a lot is that we're actually quite, the higher up we get, so to first team level, we become very convergent and we become very trapped into this is how we do things around here, and then we'll wait until someone else innovates. And innovation in sport often happens like out of season, which would be a reasonable time to do a bit of divergent thinking, or possibly in the Southern Hemisphere more often than the Northern Hemisphere. Where have you seen divergent thinking done well?
Why on that, actually, why would the Southern Hemisphere, are you talking rugby specifically, or?
Yeah, partly a couple of reasons. One is the people might say they don't have relegation in their competition, so people might feel more secure with their jobs. Second thing is, with the law variations, they often get trialled in the Southern Hemisphere first. So the 50-20-20, the 50-22 rule is currently being trialled in the, I think it's the NRC in Australia. It's not being trialled now, it was being trialled. And the same, they've done it with ITM. So they almost get a year's head start because they get to do the law variations first and work out what works.
Nice. Yeah. You know, there's a common theme there. So you asked me who does it well. Well, it's places and organizations or environments where it's allowed to try stuff. And I think this is really important to say. It's right. Your first team, whether that's sport or in the business world, your most important pitch, project or meeting you've got, is not a place for loads of trial, right? That's not your place. But there needs to be a place where it can happen. So, you know, I always ask, first question I ask if I go in and work with a team or a group of leaders or a leader is where does failure live around here? And actually, I've kind of changed that language because failure is a bit defeatist, but where does risk live? Probably won't fail, that's the point, but where are you allowing some risk of failure to happen? I was really fortunate to spend a bit of time with the England rugby senior men's team, as you know, a couple of years ago, and I asked that of Eddie Jones, and he said Mondays. which I thought was just a brilliant answer. He probably didn't even remember answering it. And I just said, where does failure live around here? He said, Mondays. So we should be trying loads of stuff on a Monday. He said, I don't want us to be failing on a, so definitely shouldn't be failing on a Saturday. And Friday, Thursday and Friday, we're just getting everything right. We're going through the motions. We're working at game pace. Monday is when we should be trying new stuff. I want us to fail. I want us to be trying things. And I thought that was really interesting. That's the same in organisations. So where organisations where they protect it to allow it to happen. The reality is you go to Silicon Valley and most Silicon Valley executives will tell you that you will never disrupt or innovate from within the core of your organization, because the corporate antibodies, the personal antibodies, i.e. most people's, you know, lack of or high sense of just protection, self-protection, will stop it from happening. So they always say, so don't do it within the core of your organization, but protect a team to do it. So, and in most corporate organizations, that's an innovation lab. So, you know, so if you're listening to this and you're not, and you're a corporate organization, where's your innovation lab? But even if you work in sport, where's your innovation lab? You know, I always go, and actually, I don't think it's that hard. You and I, when you were working with England, you know, we'd always talk about the younger age groups in the pathway as being brilliant innovation laboratories to try stuff. You still got your antibodies, parents probably, you know, who kind of want to win. We've still got all this hang up of what good looks like in our first team, and it's the same rules within the pathway. You know, you and I have often challenged people around us going, does it matter? Let's take, you know, if we keep England, well, let's not talk about England, but let's, you know, a elite sport organization with a senior team and then a pathway, you know, my push is, does it matter if the pathway ever win? Does it matter? And of course, there's probably some negative impact if they never win on morale and psychology, although maybe that's the leader's job to protect that. But if this pathway never, if England's pathway never win a game, but England win the World Cup every time, surely that's the goal.
Yeah, and there's actually very little correlation between 20s World Cups and World Cups. So just because your under 20 team does really well doesn't mean that your first team does really well.
Right.
So it's actually, you know, there isn't that much correlation. And I guess I would see it as a bit like your Google X, that it's a place where we can try stuff and we can actually look at, actually, what's the impact? So some things we looked at back in the day, you know, what's the impact of lifting the ball off the floor? What's the impact of setting traps in defence? Stuff that doesn't currently happen at the top end of the game, but we can try it and we can share some insights. We can call it, and I love your word, call it experiments. And even when I've said this before, but I've asked the same question, Max Caldas, Dutch hockey Olympic winning coach, and he just said, yeah, we do it behind closed doors. So they do it with their first team, but they play matches behind closed doors against club teams, and that's their innovation lab.
Nice. And it's just got to, it makes sense, right? You've got to have it. And actually, a lot of people do. I don't believe that there's any relatively well-performing team or business or organisation, sport or business world, that's doing okay that doesn't have it. But it probably isn't very thought through. It's probably not deliberate. It's probably just relying on the appetite and the curiosity of its people, which is really good. And that's a real shame. So, for example, what are the structures? I think where leaders need to help this is to put structures around it. So you talk about Google X. In Google X, they are paid a bonus to shut down projects. You know, so actually, if you think about where the friction sits, and they put the friction around pushing on with an idea and then take the friction away from killing it. Because, it kind of is a bit counterintuitive to what I was talking about earlier about having the behaviors where you nurture and things and allow them to breathe. But their point is, we want people to feel okay about failing. So actually, we're going to pay you a bonus for just, if you've given everything a go, and we've tried stuff and we've given it its best shot and it's not going to work, well then just stop it. We don't want there to be any delayed or just unnecessary hanging on to stuff for the sake of it. So I think it's a really nice example of a structure there. But then you hear there's loads of pockets of great stories. I think it was LG Gore, is it? Gore, the company that made Gore-Tex and lots of other things. So there, if you led a project in an innovation project and it didn't work, you know, it was seen to not come to anything, you were automatically put as the head of the next project, the innovation project. So it's a really brilliant structure. Again, we want people that have learned stuff and are bringing it to their projects. So I think it's a really nice example there as well. But leaders have got to do stuff to signal that it's important, that it's okay to fail. You know, there's a great example. Coca-Cola bought a brilliant business called Wanaloo, Work Now Locally. So the kind of example of Task Rabbit, but basically it was just fulfillment jobs, you know, working the cash register in a shop or stacking shelves, you know, last minute stuff in the US, based in Silicon Valley in San Francisco. And it worked really well. And Coca-Cola bought it because it was a great example of helping them with their distribution, right? Because they had a really slow juggernaut distribution network. And this allowed it to be, you know, using this organization, they could make it a lot simpler and save $1 billion or make $1 billion more. It's pretty incredible. But then all of the culture at Coca-Cola at that time was counterintuitive to what Wanaloo was about, which was, you know, trying new stuff. They brought everyone over to Atlanta and everyone was just started going, well, where's my pension then? Why? What's this bonus scheme you're talking about? So, you know, they kind of lost its culture. So I think it's really important that as leaders that you don't just rely on the curiosity and the brilliance of your people, but actually you are showing, you know, I call it big picture, little deeds. What's the big picture? We want to be a team, a culture that tries stuff. Well, what's your little deed what's your iconic action that's actually backing up that it is important to you? Because otherwise it's just talk.
So if you were to take over a rugby team or a football team, how would you factor this in? What would it look like for you? What do you think it would look like?
Well, this isn't, you know, listen, there's no such thing, as Steve Jobs said, no such thing as a new idea, just ideas stolen with pride from other worlds or just fresh connections in our head. And so, listen, I'm not saying this is groundbreaking, but I really like what Brentford do with regards to their B team. So their B team can lose every game because they're not in a league. Their setup means they can't be in a league. They're not aligned to under 23s or something. So I like that. They can try new stuff. So they do get creative in their B team. And there's other examples I know of that in football and other sports. So that's really good. I would divide it into three. So I would go, where's our crazy disruptive hypotheses going to come from? And that might be lower age groups, or it might be, but it's far away from the first team. And I would allow that just to thrive and be crazy. I would find ways to incentivize people to come up with hypotheses for how things might be a bit better. Elon Musk talks a lot, you know, the guy from Tesla talks a lot. He says, actually, the problem isn't having ideas, it's often finding problems. You know, if you've got a lot of smart people, you've got a good culture and you've got some good skills and behaviours, you can figure out solutions aren't often that hard. Actually, it's trying to find a problem or an opportunity that hasn't been explored before. And so, you know, put incentives in place for people just to bring problems. You know, there's a bit of a cliche, isn't it? Don't bring problems, bring solutions. Actually, I'd encourage people bringing me problems. What's the stuff that as a leader you're not exposed to? What's the stuff that the players are having to go through and experience in that we could make a bit better for them? So I would create some, you'd have to protect some parts of your organization just to go crazy and try new stuff. Otherwise you'd never do anything different. You'd want some of your stuff probably later on in your pathway to be your rapid experimenters. So these are the ones that take those crazy hypotheses and experiment with them, see if there's value in them. And one of three things will happen. Either no, just, you know, brilliant, great, let's celebrate the fact that was another hypothesis, there's nothing in it. Secondly, the thing that might happen is, oh, there's something in that, it's not quite working, but go back, have another play with it, come back to us when you think, you know, you've tweaked it a little bit. and or in the end goal would hopefully be that some things escalate themselves to your first team and become competitive advantage for a little while, right? It won't ever be, you can't rest on your laurels, but if every season we have two or three ways of doing things a bit differently in our first team, then that's a competitive edge for me. But you can't just expect that to happen in your elite team. You need to have the whole organisation behind it.
Nice. A couple of things. I just did a pod earlier today with Richie Gray, who's a coach. He coached with South Africa and Scotland. And one of the things he spoke about was he loves it as a coach going. So when he coached Scotland, they were real underdogs. They weren't physically as big as everyone else. He helped Blitzbocker, the South African Sevens team, would be the smallest team on the circuit. And he loved the fact that they had a problem that he was going to come in and help them solve, i.e. that they just weren't, they were on a slightly different physical sized game to other people. The other one that I was thinking a bit about was Croatian football. And I know one of their kind of goals is to be the most unpredictable team in the world. So the benefit of this in sport is being unpredictable. The reality is, I watch a lot of sport and I can tell you what's about to happen in the next couple of minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of people, and I guess it's that where, when is that okay? Because it probably is okay a lot of the time. Unpredictable all the time.
To the opposition, predictable to yourself, unpredictable to the opposition.
Yeah. But, and there's a bit of me that's like, look, the reality is you can't just go in and go, oh, we're just going to go crazy. You know, I think of like poker. So somebody who's unpredictable in poker can do well. If you're just totally unpredictable every time, you don't really know how to play the game almost, you're never going to get to the absolute top. So there are times when you want to go through convention, even if we think about, I don't know why I'm going jumping into the world of rugby or football and that kind of 90-minute, 80-minute kind of structure. You can't do it the whole time. Let's look at Djokovic in tennis. You know, plays five sets, three and a half of the sets are pretty. He's pretty consistent. You know what he's going to do, and that's fine. And that's that. And then he just, especially if he's losing, he's got a bit of a reputation for just going slightly crazy and unpredictable, and people not knowing what he's doing, whether it's feigning injury or just looking lethargic and, you know, playing those mind games. But he doesn't do that the whole game. You know, he picks his moments for it, if you like. And so I think that's a skill in itself, is knowing when to call it and when do you want consistency. Because any innovation or creativity, whether it's during a game or just within your holistic culture, would be it's exhausting if all you did the whole time was, what if we did this? What if we did that? That, like I said, that's that creative muse. That's that. It's like you have to benefit from your creativity. So I almost see it as a bit of like an ebb and flow. Like, oh, we see an opportunity or a problem. Right, let's get creative. What new ways can we do to think about that? Come up with some new ways, execute them, and hopefully you benefit from them for a while. And then when you stop benefiting from them, then you go again and look for new ways. So it shouldn't be an always on, because otherwise you'll never, firstly, it's exhausting. You'll never allow yourself to benefit from it.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of your con artist and their confidence as well, that actually it might just be about little increments at times as well.
Yeah, listen, disruptive innovation is expensive and rarely works, right? That's people go, oh, we need to disrupt this. We need to really tear things up and do it again. I go, great. Have you got the money, the appetite and the support from your most senior stakeholders to do that? Because that's what you need. You know, Google X, I don't know the exact numbers anymore, but let's take Google X again. It's Google's most advanced disruption lab. And it's allowed to fail somewhere between 70 and 90% of the time, right? So, you know, great. Like that's allowed, and it's ring fenced and protected, and we accept that. So when people come in and go, oh yeah, we've got to tear things up and do things again, actually rarely do they back it up, because they say that, but then they go, oh, but we can't afford to lose on Saturday, or we can't afford to lose.
Where have you seen this done really well? Where have you noticed it done well? And who are the people as well that you've seen who are kind of impressed you in these areas?
Well, I'll speak generic whilst I think of specific individuals. Listen, there is something about there is a characteristic of people that want to, that are going, and you know, the entrepreneurs, the disruptive innovators. Number one, they don't care if they've got a job this time next year.
Like, yeah, I was thinking a bit about, like, one of the antibodies is that, is fear of losing your job, is hierarchy.
Listen, I train it, and I like to think I'm pretty good at helping teams and organisations to build their creative muscle, whether it's at disruption or everyday incremental problem-solving skills. But I'm not that person. I worry too much about my mortgage being paid. So, that's the truth, or the fact of the matter. So number one, when I see these people that really kind of, I go, oh my God, they blow me away. It's because they don't care if they've got a job next year, either because they're not motivated in any way by money, or they've got enough. Yeah, you know, and it is that, you know, it's that they either have none and they don't care, or they got so much of it that they can afford to be that. And actually, when I look at some of the brilliant talent around me at Google, it's a bit in the middle, really. You know, we're very privileged. Everybody there is very privileged. But it's a bit of the middle. They also just have a confidence that they will get another job, right? It's like, well, if this doesn't work, I'll get another one. It's fine. I'll go and work somewhere else. So I really mean that. And if you're sitting there now as a senior leader within your organization, or even just your little team, your dynamic, it doesn't have to be the boss of the boss of the boss. You know, if you're the senior person within your little setup, and you're sitting there going, yeah, I'm like you, Kirk, I'm not that disruptor. Well, go and get someone who is, right? You know, surround yourself by them, bring someone in who'll do that for you. You probably won't be able to change yourself. It's probably part of your DNA that, if you've not totally torn things up and broken the rules to this point, you're probably not going to. So but brings people in. So I think that's really, so that would be one thing, is people that are really up for changing things. I've got to say, I've partnered with Adidas a little bit over the last few years, in and around their marketing, their brand business, their sports marketing and so on. And they've been really, really, good at this. Within, if you think of them as a huge global corporate organization with massive competitor set and being disrupted as well themselves, because as you can now run electricity through threads of clothing, you know, like clothing is and can be connected now. It can be a connected device. So in that world, Adidas, you could argue Google and Apple are a competitor to them. So the ability for Eric, their CMO, and their entire board to go out there and disrupt themselves, I think has been pretty impressive. They've worked hard as a corporate organization. A couple of other things that which help. So you asked before about how do you do this? How do you get creative? What would I do if I went into a sporting organization? I'd probably employ some people that weren't from sport. In certain roles, and it's the same in business. I'd like, why doesn't business employ more leaders from sport? I'll say this, I don't think I'm sharing anything that's confidential, but Jamie Heaslip, recently, you know, retired from Leinster, came and worked at Google for a bit, and he's got a brilliant growth mindset. He just came to learn about the digital world, and he's doing, you know, soak up everything he can. But I wasn't close enough to him. I didn't work with him every day, but we certainly didn't soak up his expertise as a leader. That guy can bring so much senior leadership to a corporate organization, and we definitely didn't utilize that. And I think it's the same the other way around as well.
Yeah, he followed me on Twitter the other day. It must be the Google connection. That's
it was. Yeah.
What?
Do you agree with that? Would you like? Does that resonate with you? Sport, like?
I mean, look.
Sports person, you tell me, why does sport not? Why do we not see? I think I know the answer, but why do you not see non-sport people in senior roles within close to the sort of the athletic side of sport.
Yeah, because we just need to look at job descriptions and how we recruit people. We say they need a UEFA license or they need a level 3 rugby qualification so we already reduce the potential gene pool.
And that's it, right? And we do the same. So we go, but do they know how to code? And do they, have they got experience, running a team in a sales team, it's, or something there. So you're right. And that's long been a frustration of mine, and it's what fuels me. It is why I do my job, is to try and shake up that hierarchy of skill set and technical expertise. The thing is, technical expertise is the easiest thing within our makeup to automate using technology. Let's take sport. The technical side of, say, football or rugby, striking of the ball, shall we say, there's no way the human eye can compete with a computer to be able to spot the detailed, if you like, analysis of how somebody's striking the ball, their physical motion, the mechanics in their leg and what that's doing, and then offer suggestion of how to make it better. The human eye isn't quick enough. I've seen examples of where in football they've hacked golf swing simulators. And to do that, right, to be able to pick up and really slow down the exact striking of the ball and how to improve that. So that's a great example where technical expertise about how to play sport, shall we say, is something that technology and automation can help us with. So therefore, even more emphasis comes on the human's ability to think differently, psychology, understand what's going on, read emotion, all those things that technology isn't going to be able to do for us anytime soon. And if you break it down like that, well, then all of a sudden you go, well, my pool of talent that I might be interested in is far wider than I thought it was.
I wrote some stuff down. I was just thinking a bit about sports. So, and some of the best kickers in the country have used that stuff to get themselves better at kicking. Recruitment, even just who's on interview panels in sport would be, it's the same, isn't it? It just doesn't have variety. I don't think we suck enough out of other people. So I spoke to a super rugby coach that visited a premiership rugby team and he said they didn't ask me a single question in the same way I would have loved to. What questions did you ask Jamie Heaslip? That would have been interesting, and I'm sure he would have asked lots of questions. I think the challenge also is that people get... So I was on a call the other day with a guy who's going to be a premiership rugby coach. He's been coaching for a year. So he's making his debut. He's, which whilst it's kind of cool, you might go, he's a naive expert, but he's not, because he's going to be drowning in work and struggling to work in this situation, and then he's not going to be able to do that much fresh thinking. Hierarchy, massive. Head coach, coaches dominate, analysts dominate, S&C dominate, psychologists, even if psychologists exist. So when you start to ask psychologists or analysts, if you were in charge, would it be different? They say, yeah, it would be significantly different. And I guess we all hire people like us, so that's
there's a lovely way that Google looks at recruitment, and it's many eyes, many times, and it's just about decision making in general, but particularly recruitment. So it's just, do we have lots of different eyes looking at the decision that we're making with recruitment? More than once. Do we come back and review it? Is it a knee-jerk decision, or do we come back to it? I think that's something that I try and adopt in lots of things I do, not just recruitment but decisions I make, is how can I get as many different types of eyes looking at this for me, with me, who and actively go and seek people that might look at it a bit differently to me. And sometimes that's quite painful, sometimes that's exposing myself, but gotta do it.
What would Well, actually, it just reminded me of Courty. So Dave Court, obviously FA, he went to the combine, to the NFL combine, and sent a report around, and he just said all the work's been done before then. So people think it's this; they're just watching people compete in some stuff. But they've been and watched them loads of times. Lots of people have seen them. They've seen them in multiple environments with different coaches. How they react. It's not. They're not making multi-million pound decisions on a 40-yard dash.
Yeah.
Which would be pretty foolish if they did.
Or ballsy. Yeah.
How are you disrupting yourself? How are you developing yourself? What's the...
So what's going on for me? So trying to... So number one, forcing myself out of my comfort zone, doing new stuff. So you made the point, just for those that don't know what we mean, bit of context. I was working on a project with my team about confidence in learning and development in the corporate world. And we spoke to Rusty, an elite coach from a different world, looking at confidence. We spoke to, you know, a squadron leader in the RAF, a heart surgeon who performed heart surgery with a robot for the very first time, and the person died. How did they get back their confidence? And this one, a confidence trickster who, you know, whose job it is to defraud people, you know, to falsely instill confidence. And this whole thing about how they did it was just try, you've got to try something small new every time, not lots, because you can't afford for it to fail, but always force yourself to try something new and different. So I've started to, I realized that I'm very fortunate people want me to come and speak about the same thing. And lots of people go, oh, can you just come and do that talk that you did before and do it again?
Roll him out.
Yeah. So I've been forcing myself to try new stuff, always ensure that there's, you know, there's about, you know, in any hour, at least a quarter of it's new and different. So, and then get feedback around it, which, you know, I'm a corporate person. Feedback's quite hard to go and get sometimes. You know, I'm worried about how it's going to affect my pay rise and so on, and all that stuff. So I'm waffling a little bit. I would summarize it. I'm trying to soak up some of the brilliant stuff I love about the elite sport world. Sporting professionals just want to get better. You get paid more if you're better. So just get better. I quite like that attitude in elite sport. So I just want to get better. I'm kind of trying to buy into that mentality a bit. I'm definitely allowing myself more thinking time. So just protecting time to think. You know, I was at a conference last year, and one of the speakers gave me a line that I've stolen with pride: busy is the new stupid, which I thought was really nice. I've used that a few times, and it's true, right? We need to totally disrupt ourselves about what good looks like. And in my world, if you're looking busy and your calendar's full, you've got this false belief that you're adding value, and it's not the case at all. And I'm starting to learn that. And working in organizations like Google really brings that to life. Google's brilliant. It doesn't really value or overly value people that look busy. It values you on impact. Here's what I'm delivering, and my behavior in how I deliver it. So for a little while, I've got to admit, we and other tech organizations forgot a bit about behaviors. And we ended up with this thing called brilliant jerks. So great people that would deliver brilliance, but absolutely awful at working with their team and so on. And we learned that that's not good, you know, at all. We'll sacrifice that. So behavior is really important as well. So, but in my case, I was kind of this guilty of this following the line of presenteeism and looking busy for the sake of it. So I've started to kind of get away from that and just go, actually, what's really important, and how do I allow myself the time to think about stuff rather than just always doing stuff.
Nice. And we're getting a bit of time at the moment, although by the sounds of your kids, you're not getting that much time. I had a question the other day that I think is a good question for you, and I should have asked it this way, but when was the last time you did something for the first time? Is a good question.
Oh, yeah. So when was the last time I did something for the first time? Oh, well, I can't answer that. It'll come to me as we as we cool. as we.
That's fine. I just had a bit of a. Go on.
One thing, it sounds weird, but one thing I've started doing a lot more of is rehearsing for presentations, for workshops, for sessions. Listen, you know, I'd like to think I'm a confident facilitator and I'm confident in the moment. You know, I believe that it's about owning the energy of a room and I'm pretty good at knowing the levers how to pull when I'm facilitating sessions. But nothing beats a little bit of practice as well, right? You know, and walking through how things might go and what you might do about it and visualization and so on. So not the first time, but I've started doing a lot more of that which just makes it less tiring, you know, because I get through a session, I'll run a workshop, it's great, we've had impact, we've come up with some new stuff, and but then I'm exhausted, and that's, you know, a bit of a martyr, so I've tried to get away from that.
Nice. I was just thinking, so I'm gonna make you the ultimate naive expert. Elliot is 10 years old, he's going to his first ever coaching session. They look over inside the pitch and they see Kirk Vallis, and he looks quite athletic because he's been training a bit, and say, oh, do you want to come and coach? What would you be thinking? What would be the key things for you if you were coaching kids? I'm assuming you never have.
No, well, I did when I was 16 17 18. I did like a you might have heard of Curver coaching, which was a football player to football from, I think it was from the US at the time. And that was it. That was a while ago. So what would I bring? And I've learned a lot of this from you. I've seen you and Fletch and some of the other guys from the England pathway and stuff. And so it can't be a coincidence. Just first is like, how do we get them to enjoy it? How do we have some fun? Gamification. Do things a bit different. I'd like to, you know, make everything a little bit surprising each time. I'd work hard at that. I think that's the biggest thing. I'd want Elliot to
surprise is a great word in coaching.
To enjoy it and a bit surprised. I think one thing I try and do when I design learning programs for the corporate world is. It's a thing, I don't know if this is a formal title for it or whether I just heard it from someone, but I call it reversing into the piece. So you get people to do something and then you explain why you've done it, right? And there's nothing new about that, and it's quite a common technique for, and I'd like to think I'd do a lot more of that. Like, let's do something and go, right, let's, and it might not go, and also design some stuff that you know isn't going to go well first time or for a while, and then you're probably looking and listening to me now and going,
it sounds like you're going to do a great job.
So I think it's a bit of that, you know, rather than sort of tell, do tell, you know, so we're going to do this and then go, right, what happened there? A bit of self-experience.
The classic in school is, here's our lesson objectives and we'll just stick to that. We're just going to do this. Well, actually, who knows where it might go? Who knows where kids might want to take it?
I read it in the, what was that book you lent me all about the Olympic sports and how they do things?
Talent Lab.
So I love that story in there about the hockey where they're thinking Thursdays. They're just those brilliant. So they just come out, here's your rules, here's your restrictions, give it a go. And what's really important, I think sport or business, is if you're going to do that, protect the time to then have the conversation. What have we learned? What was interesting about that? What was different? What are you going to take? And that's something that we don't do well in business at all. You know, coaching is still often telling.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, actually. So where does coaching sit for you guys? It's clearly a pretty important skill for your for your managers. Where are you? What's the stuff you're exploring?
I think it's just all a bit boxy, right? It's all a bit like, there are lots of executive coaches, and in my world I work in people development, I work in HR essentially. There's a real buzz at the moment. Everyone in HR wants to become a qualified coach. and is. And so you get a lot of very experienced executive coaches and who sit at that end of the spectrum, you know, like don't tell anyone anything, you know, you don't have to be a leader, you don't even have to have context. You just help the person that you're coaching thinking through it. And then you've got the everyday manager in the corporate world. And again, I'm stereotyping quite crudely here, so apologies, because there are brilliant examples of people that don't do this. But then you've got the everyday manager who just tell, instruct, you know, directional, coaching. And the challenge, so where I see it is that that's what you have. And we need to build this muscle of flexing along the spectrum for a lot better. And also recognizing that all of the spectrum is valid. It is okay to tell people at certain times. It's okay to be very forward at times. But then there's also moments where there's an opportunity just to help people sort of explore. The corporate world would use the non-directional end of the coaching spectrum as almost a bit of fluffiness. You know, not actually, I'm not sure the corporate world necessarily sees that as a tool to use when times are tough, right? When the shit hits the fan, excuse my language, but like that, you do that in your sort of informal appraisals and your career development chats, but not as something you'd use when you're just about to go into a really important meeting and it's got to go well. And so I think we just need to be a bit better at it. There's a great coach called Bill Campbell, who actually worked in sport as well. So he was a collegiate coach with college football, but also worked in the corporate world, and he was coach to many of Google's senior leaders. And he was a brilliant example of somebody who just had this ability to flex across the spectrum. He passed away, unfortunately, a couple of years ago. So that's where I think the sport world and the business world, probably we could all generally get better at our ability to value the full spectrum wherever we sit on it.
Nice, yeah, and it definitely depends. Being skillful would be important, and actually the fact that we met Drakey in Google HQ the other day, Nick Drake, would seem to suggest that. I mean, Drakey would be very skillful at that stuff. So for someone to be in a relatively senior leadership position in your organization with Drakey's skills is pretty cool as far as I see it.
Yeah, and it's not like that's where I need to get better. I'm very tell. My natural thing would be to be directional. I need to sit in one of your team talks, because I've never seen you tell anyone to do anything. Like, you know, you're brilliant at that other end. And so I guess that would be our question, is how good are we at just all of us at flexing gracefully along the spectrum without anyone noticing, almost?
Nice way to put it. If you did come into our world, so back into the pathway, what would be the... what would be the first three things you'd do? John Fletcher question. He obviously always looking for feedback. What would be the first three things you would do?
If I think back if I use the context of the England pathway that I knew it when you and I first met, I would go, first thing I'd do is I'd break it down to what I said earlier. So I'd say, right, where's our total disruption? And I'd make you head of that. I'd go and just. Your only objective, your measure of success would be that every 6 months you come to me with half a dozen audacious bits of thinking and a little bit of experiment. So I want a little bit of data, right? You know, this is the thing, right? But I want a bit of data. But the data is you've been to Wellington, tried it out for a few afternoons with different age groups, and done. You know, and you think there's something in it, right? Or something like that, right? So give me something where you've test the premise of your thinking. So that would be one. So I divide it like that, and then some rapid experimenters, and then probably head of the what would it be? What's the most senior team in the pathway under 20s?
20s, yep.
But is so, you know, and that would be where we divide the talent up to execute some of that stuff. So that would be first thing I'd do is to create that. Second thing I would do, probably learn the game of rugby a bit better. I've learned it quite well over the last few years. And bring in more. We've spoken about it. Where's the cognitive diversity? So that's what I'd ask myself: is where is there people that are looking at this in a different way to each other? There's a lot of talk in the world at the moment about diversity, and it leads us naturally to gender or ethnicity and so on. I think that's really important. But actually, I think there's a level above that, which is just cognitive diversity. If we sit there and go, how can I get people to look at this problem in a different way to how I am? Well, then you'd probably naturally have better gender balance. But you'd also address other areas of inequality with social background. And, you know, I loved it when you introduced me to Ellis Genge, an event before one of the England games. And it, you know, from the start, you could just see somebody whose background means he just looks at the game in a totally different way, and it's refreshing, right? And it seems to be working. I know that he's sort of, impressing Eddie.
He's doing all right.
So I guess where can we get some cognitive diversity?
Nice. And what about what are you noticing with people coming into Google? Similarly with us, with the younger kind of Generation Z type stuff, is there any stuff you're noticing there about
So this is interesting. As a leader, you know, we have to. This probably isn't that new, but I can only speak from my point in time, as you know, where I am in my maturing years. I think it's pretty pronounced now how different generations are using different forms of communication tools. So, you know, I laugh at the leaders around me who cringe at seeing themselves on video. You know, again, hopefully this crisis and working will address some of that. But we have to remember, with, you know, the younger generations coming through, they're recording themselves. They're not typing away on WhatsApp. They're talking to it, or they're video themselves and so on. And so I think that's something we all have to recognize is there's a totally different way of communicating. So if you're a leader and you're using the communication method that was used when you were younger.
Typewriter for me.
Yeah, yeah.
I have actually used a typewriter. I mean, that's how old I am.
Memo in triplicate. Yeah. But that, it's out the window. So you've got to. So I don't manage a big team right now. And but if I did, that would be my massive learn for me would be, I need to very quickly understand how to communicate better across lots of different ways with everyone, right? And so I think that's one thing that we're seeing. There's a lot more. I think this scrappiness. I think all the things that I've said in this conversation we've had that we need to be better at, you know, being wrong, scrappy, trying new things. I think we're naturally seeing that. YouTube just has allowed people to just do stuff. It's totally torn up the rule book of what good editing looks like, for example. So that's just one example of where people are just allowing themselves to be a bit more strapping.
Tiger King, mate, I've just watched Tiger King, and it is poor editing. It's actually quite a, you know, this guy's just videoed something with his video camera, and it's become they were saying it's like the most popular documentary in the world.
Right, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. You know, so I think, so we, all the things that we've been talking about on this call is the stuff that I think the younger generation are naturally doing. They're more confident. They'll speak up. They won't just go with hierarchy for hierarchy's sake. Doesn't appeal to them. They'll go against it. But also as well, there's also, I think, a potential watch out that, perhaps, are they as well prepared for social interaction? And that's a big watch out. So I can imagine a load of people right now of the younger generation loving working from home. loving it, right? You know, they just get to, because they can interact in ways that really cut, you know, that they're really comfortable with, and that's it. So that's a big watch out is with younger generation coming through, just ensuring that they don't lose sight of the value of a coffee and a chat and kicking something about with somebody and going for a walk or that kind of stuff. You know, it's that technology doesn't take over too much.
Yeah, I'm always underestimating my son who loves his phone, because then people will go, oh, your son is so chatty. He's so good with people whenever he's with other people. I'm thinking, is he? I just don't see that side of it. My last thing, I normally do the one word is, I'm actually going to ask you for your dream team. So whatever your dream job is, you know, let's imagine you are a manager of Liverpool. What would your dream job be? Do you have anything? What would your dream job be?
Oh, well, right now, I always go, wouldn't it be great to be sporting director of Man United? You know, there's a lot of talk about that role. So, if you like, I'm a Man U fan. So,
yeah, they've just appointed someone, haven't they?
Have they? Oh, have they? Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so, I suppose
Man United or Man City?
Man City, sorry, yeah.
So Man United.
But
yeah,
so director at Man United. Which people, dead or alive, are you taking to be on your team? Your top four or five?
Who'd I have with me? I've got to have someone from the tech world. I was going to say Steve Jobs, but I think I'd say Bill Gates now. Bill Gates has definitely changed. Like, his reputation has gone up in my world during this whole crisis.
He's been unbelievable, hasn't he?
He's definitely, I guess, age has allowed him to chill out. I hear stories about he was pretty cutthroat. But I just think that kind of voice of wisdom, if you like, someone looking over you who looks at it. I really think, you know, that tech sort of background. Tech people is... I think the tech world gets a bad rep in other worlds. Their ability just to look at things quite unemotional sometimes is a real handy thing. So I'd have that. I'd bring in Eric Cantona. I think why not? You know, he's got that affiliation to the club.
Bring in the Maverick. To mentor other, in inverted commas, Mavericks.
Right, there's a bit of that. Definitely to what we were talking about earlier. So people, not just saying this, people like yourself and Fletch from a different world, but more importantly, just totally would help to look at the culture and make it a place where people probably want to be and to challenge ourselves. So there you go. There's four.
Nice. I'm honoured to be in your team. I wanted you to add Sir Bobby Robson because I watched I binged this weekend. So I watched the Bobby Robson movie as well, and I would want to be coached by Bobby Robson.
Yeah, he was that was a great example, wasn't it? So yeah, I heard lots of great stories. I might have even seen that documentary where he was a great example of a manager who treated everybody equal, didn't treat everybody the same, knew how to treat people in different, I had to interact with that player in that way, that player in a different way, but everybody was treated fairly, if you like. So I thought, yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful documentary. Mate, where can people get hold of you? Are you venturing out into Twitter or are you still resisting?
No, still not. I apologise. So I've got to say, I apologise to any, but lots of people have followed me recently and they get nothing. So I should, I really should, just as a way of just thanking people. I make lots of videos and then unlist them on YouTube. So there are lots of videos of me, but they're not listed on YouTube. So they're only available if I share them. So I should start sharing them. So listen, if any of this was interesting, or if you just got some feedback, give me some feedback. Tell me how I could have made this conversation a bit more impactful, how I might have offered a bit more impact for those of you listening. So reach out to me, kirktvallis@gmail.com.
Right, hopefully you get lots of emails. The reason I think you're impactful, I mean, you clearly got to pay your mortgage, but I do think when you go into other worlds, you're very good at not trying to solve their problems and just to and to create the right question. And then the other thing, which is your superpower, although you're starting to develop more and more of them, is you're a good storyteller. I think it's a powerful skill to have.
Cheers, buddy.
So there's my feedback for you. Mate, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Always nice to you. We should do this again soon. It's been a pleasure. Mate, go and enjoy the family. And we'll catch up soon.
See you soon. Take care. Bye-bye.